Hey guys, welcome to Fitness Mentor's presentation of the online course for the ACE CPT exam. We are here to get you started on Chapter 8 and specifically go over the PowerPoint lecture. So, what is Chapter 8 about? Chapter 8 really focuses on physiological assessments. Okay, so we learned a little bit about, we'll say, postural assessments and functional assessments in the previous chapter, but now we're going to really focus on, you know, at what is the current state of health of the client from a physiological perspective? Okay, and that's really what we're looking to assess. So let's go ahead and flip over to or scroll over to slide number 2. And specifically, as we talk about physiological assessments, we're thinking about things like what is their current body fat? What is their current muscle strength testing? What is their cardiorespiratory fitness? Skill-related assessments as well can be considered physiological as they are measuring, we'll say, capacity or aerobic capacity or even total VO2 intensity levels and markers for performance as well. So, once again, the health-related assessments, cardiorespiratory assessments, body composition assessments, whether that be like a skinfold assessment and so on and so forth. The muscular testing, strength, endurance, flexibility can also be included there, as well as skill-related assessments such as power, speed, agility, reactivity, or quickness, and coordination. All right, so moving over to slide number 3, we're first going to go over body composition. And body composition is basically the makeup of all of the tissue in your body. Specifically, we're measuring how much fat you have compared to your total body weight. And that determines your body fat percentage. So all of the weight in your body that is not fat is going to be considered lean weight. And then you also have body fat weight, which is all the weight in your body that is fat. So it says, before testing, always explain to the client that they may feel uncomfortable at certain points. So with any of these assessments, there will be some people that are not that comfortable with you, we'll say, touching them. For instance, the picture on the right shows a man having his thigh skinfold measurement measured. And, you know, he's pulling up his shorts. That may be uncomfortable for some people. So you always have to explain, you know, why you're doing the assessment, what it's for, and then how you're going to do it. And that explanation usually helps people to feel comfortable regarding your exactly the assessment that you're doing. And if they know what it's for, they'll be a little bit more comfortable too, as they can kind of understand what they're getting out of this assessment. All right, so always make sure the client's comfortable. Ask them, discuss it with them before performing it on them. And I always say, whenever teaching someone something, always use the what, the why, the how, which is what are you doing, why are you doing it, and then how are you going to do it. And that explains it and makes them feel confident in what is going on. So body composition and anthropometric measurements, more or less. The lean and fat tissue. So what is lean tissue? I already kind of discussed it, but lean tissue lean body mass consists of muscles, connective tissue, bones, all other tissues such as skin, hair, nails, also blood, nervous system tissue, organs. All of the weight that is not fat is considered lean tissue. Okay, and all of the tissue that is fat is considered fat tissue. So adipose tissue, it may be referred to as well. So adipose, ADIPOSE, adipose tissue. You'll hear that in the field as well. But how do you measure body composition? Well, there's one main way that you will do it in the field, and that's the skinfold measurements. But ACE wants you to know that the best benchmark for measuring body composition is going to be what's called hydrostatic weighing. And hydrostatic weighing is basically considered underwater weighing. And what it does is you're in a tank of water that is able to measure the total weight of you, and what you do is you exhale as hard as you can, as fast as you can, and as much as you can, and then let your body sink underwater. They measure the weight of your body underwater, and then that right there allows the or is put or that weight right there is put into an equation, also including your age, and your sex, that even sometimes height too. And all of that determines your body fat within a 1.5 to 2% margin of error. So that's probably the most accurate way of weighing. They do have certain body fat or body composition trucks that will drive around and measure people at certain gyms. But usually the hydrostatic weighing is only in an exercise physiology laboratory. And yeah, I had a good amount of experience utilizing this in a exercise physiology classroom, as well as the trucks that would come by many of the local gyms that we went to. And I also had my clients do it to assess their full body fat. So it's not the most convenient or comfortable way to measure body fat, but it is the most accurate according to ACE. And also, guys, there is, in my opinion, more accurate ways, but they're expensive. Things like MRIs, certain body scans, and then even some of the newer what's called bioelectrical impedance scales. The in-body, 7,000 is one of them. That's claims to be within a percentage of accuracy, and I believe that is pretty dang close. So I've done a lot of different types of body fat measuring, and I really liked that one the best. It was the fastest, and it gave you a full printout regarding the amount of muscle you had in each body segment, the amount of fat and where it was stored, total weight, BMI, height, all that good stuff. And I loved that because one of the gyms that I worked at, I was able to measure that on a monthly basis to track my progress. And, if I had the specific goal of gaining muscle in my biceps or we'll say right or arms, I could directly measure the total weight in my right arm or the total weight in my arms 1 month versus the total weight in my arms the next month of muscle tissue, which is really cool, really accurate. Those do cost anywhere from $5,000 to $10,000 for those machines. So some gyms will have them, some won't, but hopefully in your career, you will get to use those as they're fun. They're cool. Very cool. Anyways, the most common way that you will be performing body composition assessments is using skin fold measurements. And what does the skin fold measurements measure? They measure subcutaneous fat. Subcutaneous refers to underneath the skin. And you're basically measuring the amount of fat that's stored under the skin. And this measurement says it's about a 6 to 8% margin for error. If you get pretty confident in performing this body composition assessment, you can be really accurate with whether the fact your clients are losing weight or losing body fat or gaining body fat, specifically because it measures the millimeters of each skin fold area. So if, month one, they have a 15 skin fold in their abdomen, and then after 2 months, you measure it again and it's a 12, you can guarantee that they lost fat in their abdominal area, because their subcutaneous fat is 3 millimeters less. That's really the comparisons that I make with my clients, because as long as I'm doing the test both times, it's pretty accurate as far as if they're losing weight or if they're gaining weight. So keep that in mind that it's not necessarily 100% about the number that comes from the skinfold measurement as much as it is the millimeters per each skinfold segment. Okay, they say 6 to 8% margin for error. In my opinion, though, when I have it done by someone that's really experienced with the skinfold calipers compared to the in-body 7,000 and underwater weighing, always had me a little higher in the 10 to 12% range. The in-body 7,000 always had me around 9%. This is at my peak, we'll say my leanest, and then the skinfold sites always had me at a 6 to 7% range. So if you kind of compare those, I would probably put myself somewhere in the middle there, maybe around that 8 to 10% range of actual body fat. But in all reality, it doesn't really matter the exact percentage you have. As what only matters is if you're progressing towards the goal that you want. And my goal was to get leaner, and I was able to go from I think my first ever skinfold measurement was about a 10% with skinfold calipers, and I was able to get that down to about 6, and I think at my lowest even 5%. I might have wiggled that a little bit more to get a little bit leaner. So, that's pretty lean for me at least. All right. So, once again, it's more about the comparison from day one to day 20, or we'll say day 60, than it is comparing the exact percentage of fat. So keep that in mind. So what is the test, skinfold measurement test called? It's called the Jackson and Pollock 3 site location. That's the one that ACE recommends that you know. We encourage that you memorize the site for both men and women. Specifically women, you utilize the triceps, thigh, and supra-ilium. Definitely have that memorized. Men utilize the chest, thigh, and abdominal. Okay, so both of them have the thigh. That's why we chose this picture on the right-hand side of this specific slide. But it's a vertical skinfold right in the middle of your thigh. The triceps is a vertical skinfold right in the in between the elbow or the elbow process and the armpit. Okay, right in the middle there, you grab the fat and pull, or about grab the skin fold, measure it there. And then the supra-ilium is a 45-degree angle on the hip. The abdominal is a vertical skin fold, 1 centimeter or 2 centimeters to the right of the belly button. And then the chest is going to be a diagonal skin fold in between the nipple and the armpit on that line, that 45-degree angle line. All right, so moving over to the next slide, slide number 4. As far as body composition goes, what is some of the norms and what are some of the programming considerations? So for males, body composition for athletes ranges about 6 to 13%. And remember, guys, there's lots of different types of athletes. So this is just kind of throwing out a number there. But we'll say, you know, even the best male offensive lineman in football, the best athlete out there is probably about around 20 to 30% body fat. So it doesn't necessarily mean that whether someone's in shape or not, it just necessarily means the type of sport they're playing, and most athletes that are very active end up being leaner, okay? But for football, you want to be big and even have a lot of body mass, so they typically keep the body fat to be more effective at their job, okay? But most athletes, when you think of athletes, soccer players, basketball players, you know, swimmers, that sort of thing, and then every other sport you could possibly imagine that's more endurance-based, the 6 to 13% is average for body fat for males. Then average or middle of the row for males is, I would put them, yeah, anywhere from 14 or 15 all the way up to 24. And then obese is considered 25% body fat or higher. Okay. That is the, yeah, you kind of the point at which you would consider someone obese is 25% or higher. But really, obesity is a body mass index of 30 or more. Okay, so I don't really want you going off of the body fat percentage to say if someone is obese as much as the body mass index, because that's what doctors use and that's what we in the field or in the personal training field should focus on. All right, for females, athletes range from about 14 to 20%. So why are females why do females typically carry more body fat? Their hormonal levels and specifically related to the process of developing children and that typically requires more fat in the body. And that's, we'll say, more of an evolutionary perspective as to why women might carry more body fat because of those hormonal levels, which are optimized for creating another human, are necessary to have that increased fat. So, yeah, there's probably other reasons too, but that's a basic general explanation. If you wanted to learn more, you could always look more into that. But that's 14 to 20% for athletes, average for or average run-of-the-mill person for body fat percentage for females is about 25 to 30%. And then obesity is 32% or higher. And once again, go off the BMI of 30 or greater for obesity. All right, so programming considerations. You want to, yeah, this is more the math side of things. And we want you to know how to do this math as it may come up as a test question. So you want to be able to calculate the lean weight, the total weight, and the body fat percentage based on the numbers given. Okay, so if someone's lean weight is 150 pounds and someone's total weight is 200 pounds, we can say, or the one question might be, how much fat does this person carry? Well, 200 minus 150 is 50 pounds of fat weight. Okay. What percentage body fat would that be? Well, take 50 and divide it by 200, and you'll get 25%. It is a quarter of 200 pounds, so 25% would be that person's body fat. The numbers will be pretty easy, kind of like the ones given here. You may need to use a calculator, which is provided on the computer application during your test for tougher math equations. But guys, yeah, definitely understand, remember, lean weight is all weight that is not fat. Total weight is 200. Therefore, we know that we can now calculate the fat weight, which is 200 minus 150. That is 50 pounds. And then based off of that fat weight and the total weight, we can calculate the body fat percentage, which is 25%. Okay, so definitely understand how to do that math to calculate all that. And it may even be a little bit more difficult numbers. So we wanted to give an easy example there, but definitely understand how to go about that math. Okay. And there is another more detailed example in the book that has harder numbers, but yeah, check that out. All right, BMI, we definitely want you to know the BMI categories, absolutely, because this is where you as a personal trainer need to potentially get a medical recommendation if somebody falls into that obesity category. So what is BMI? BMI is body mass index. It's basically the weight of the person divided by their height squared. So kilograms over meter squared is the equation, weight in pounds divided by height in inches squared times 703. That's the imperial non-metric equation, but they want you to know kilograms over meter squared, but doing the conversions might be a little bit hard for you if you don't know the conversion rates and all that stuff. So that's why I brought that up. Anyways, BMI underweight is below 18.5. Normal weight, this one you definitely need to have memorized, and obesity, those are the two main ones. But 18.5 to 24.9 is normal weight. Okay. Overweight is 25 to 29.9 or 25 to 30. And then obesity, we just want you to know obesity. You don't need to know the grades of obesity. Obesity is 30 to 35 or 30 or higher. Okay, that's the obesity. If somebody is in the obese category and has any other issues, they may need medical clearance to start an exercise program with you. Keep that in mind. All right, so let's go and move over to slide 5 as we talk about girth assessments, furthering these physiological assessments. Girth assessments are specifically talking about measuring the circumference of body segments. Okay, so like the picture shows here on the right-hand side of this slide, this male trainer is measuring this female trainer's circumference of her arm, her left arm. So the sites that you want to do and measure are abdomen, arm, glutes, or hips. Well, basically, yeah, the hip width, calf, forearm, middle of the thigh, upper thigh potentially, and waist. Those are the ones recommended by ACE. And also, guys, it is important if you have a client that wants to gain muscle, for instance, in their shoulders or in their biceps or arms, you can directly determine if somebody is growing based off of the circumference measurements, which is great. So if you gain 1 inch on your biceps, that's huge, and that means your biceps definitely got bigger. Okay. Also waist to hip ratio. This can be a measurement that you can track with your clients as far as health goes. Apple shape person is Android. Apple shape would have a larger stomach as opposed to wider hips, make them more of a rounder appearance. Pear shaped, which is more common to females, is storing body fat in the hips and or lower body and not in the abdomen. So where is there a risk factor associated with the waist to hip ratio? When males have a measurement of greater than 0.95, or when females have a ratio measurement of greater than 0.86. Females have larger hips due to the birthing process, and that's why their number is a little bit lower. More or less, it's the ratio between the waist width to the hip width. That ratio will give you that 0.95 or 0.86, mainly stating that the waist should be smaller than the hips. For males, it's a little closer, but females, the hips should definitely be wider than the waist by a ratio of 0.86 or less. All right, waist circumference. When might someone be at high risk? When someone's waist is above 39 or basically above 40 You don't need to know direct numbers for that, but when somebody has a waist circumference, like their pant size, of 39.5 or higher, that is a high risk, meaning obesity and or other symptoms or other issues. Females is 35.5 or higher. Yeah, 35 to 43 puts you at high risk as far as waist circumference. All right, moving along to slide 6. We're going to get into cardiorespiratory fitness testing. Cardiorespiratory fitness testing is really, it's going to be important for two populations. One of them is the extremely out of shape population that wants to feel better as they, or wants to get in shape. They want to feel good when they climb upstairs. They want to be able to keep up with their kids or grandkids and so on and so forth. The other population is professional athletes that are directly, or that their sport directly relates to a cardiorespiratory training level. And if you measure them at one level, the goal for them is to improve that level in order to get better at their endurance-based sport. So how can you do it? There's a fitness center you can do it on certain machines like a bike or a treadmill, or lab assessments in which you directly measure things like VO2 via breathing into a apparatus. One thing is a graded exercise test, GXT is what it's known as. That's in which you increase the intensity as time goes on until you reach a max intensity. Then also you have a VO2 max, which is directly measuring someone's intake of oxygen versus their output of carbon dioxide. You get a volume of oxygen in your body, or basically the volume of oxygen used by your body. So oxygen consumption, you may hear that called. Those are the main ones. Typically in the fitness setting, we only estimate VO2 max based off of a certain test. There's a test like the 1.5 mile run that can assess a VO2, or even a few treadmill tests like the Rockport walk test, or I think there's even another one, I forget the exact name of it, but it's a graded exercise test in which you're walking uphill, and then they take the heart rate associated with the person's height, weight, to determine an age and sex, to determine their cardiorespiratory efficiency, and estimate VO2 max. Yeah, so you as a personal trainer will never get someone's actual VO2 max. You'll just estimate it. But an estimate is really good, because if you have one estimate at you know, we'll say 40, a VO2 max of 40, if in 2 months you do another test and that VO2 max has gone to 45, you can guarantee to that person that they are more cardiorespiratorily, or more in shape, we'll say. All right, so how do you determine max heart rate? This is the one I want you to know, is 220 minus age. And that can show up on the test, so I want you to have that memorized. 220 minus age is the most simple way to estimate maximal heart rate. Okay? If you have a client that is 20 years old, their max heart rate is 200. If you have a client that's 30 years old, that client's max heart rate is 190. Pretty simple, allows you to create some heart rate training zones and assist you with cardiorespiratory programming. If you wanted to do more math, you can do the heart rate reserve method, which is basically also takes into account someone's resting heart rate to determine a specific maximal heart rate. But I like 220 minus age. ACE will never really ask you much about heart rate reserve, most likely. Just know that. And those two other formulas right there are other ways of measuring maximal heart rate. Okay. Which are very similar. One is 208 times 0.7 times age, and the other one is 206.9, basically 207 minus 0.67 times age. So, yeah. Anyways, the cycle ergometer test is kind of what I talked about. That's a submaximal VO2 test that you can do in the field. I believe they have the protocol in the textbook, but if not, you can always look that up online to have a direct protocol for a submaximal cycle ergometer test. But treadmill, Rockport walk test is going to be way easier for you as the personal trainer to use. All right, next, as we move over to slide number 7, ventilator threshold testing, or VT, remember? Ventilatory threshold from the previous chapters. Ventilatory threshold, there's VT1 and VT2. This is going to kind of explain what those are and how to or kind of guesstimate where those are at. Anyways, first one, tidal volume. This is the normal volume of air inhaled per breath. Okay, this is your normal breathing. This entire time I've been talking, I've been taking normal small breaths. That's called tidal volume. That's your up and down consistent breathing, maybe when you sleep. Okay, usually I think only about I think that's only about one total liter. I can't remember the exact thing from exercise physiology, but tidal volume is usually pretty small. You don't need a ton of to breathe a ton when you're at rest, just kind of relaxing. Minute ventilation is the volume of air breathed per minute. That's the volume of oxygen consumed, we'll say. And then anaerobic glycolysis is directly related to carbohydrate use. And anaerobic glycolysis is really where you're at really high intensities that are not sustainable. That's your anaerobic glycolysis. This is your like going as hard as you can for 30 to 50 seconds before oxygen is needed to create more energy, because the anaerobic glycolysis system kind of taps out around that 30 to 50 seconds, more or less. Then you have your ventilatory threshold 1, or VT1, first ventilatory threshold. And this is the point at which intensity at which blood lactate accumulates faster than it can be cleared. Therefore, you need to increase your breathing rate. Okay, so this is just increased the point of increased breathing. Okay. Sometimes your heart rate can go as high as 90 beats per minute to almost 100 beats per minute before you need increased breathing. The point at which you have to noticeably breathe more is VT1. Second ventilatory threshold is the lactate threshold. I want you guys to know that just because every once in a while they'll throw something like that on the test. But VT2 is the lactate threshold. It's the point at which lactate is rapidly increasing at a high rate and the body cannot clear it fast enough. This is sometimes what you feel, or some people have related it to the lactate buildup. Lactic acid buildup is what creates the burn in the muscle. Not 100% proven, but that is a good simple explanation you can use with your client, that when you know the muscle is burning, that's lactic acid building up and the body's unable to clear it as fast, so eventually it will burn so much that you will need to stop. And that is what is known as fatigue, muscular fatigue. And then also VT2 is heavy breathing, hyperventilation not adequate to keep up with increased acidity, so intensity is not sustainable. Basically, you can't breathe hard enough or enough to get enough oxygen to clear out and produce all of that energy that you're using. So you have to decrease in intensity over the course of 30 seconds to a minute, otherwise you will, collapse, more or less. All right, moving on to slide 8. Now we get into more of the, you know, what can you use as a personal trainer with the VT1 and VT2 tests. So a submaximal talk test, okay? We probably mentioned this before, but the talk test is what is going to determine VT1, okay? It's a simple way to determine VT1, whereabouts that is, what heart rate. And it is best performed with a heart rate monitor, which is a telemetry strap, we'll call it. Watch. Nowadays, you can have something like the Apple Watch or Heart Rate Watch, Smart Watch, measure your heart rate a lot more easily than wearing a strap in a specific watch. So what is the submaximal talk test? This is the point at which you can, I think I brought it up in the last chapter or two, but the point at which you can complete a sentence without breathing is passing the talk test. The point at which you cannot complete a sentence without breathing is failing the talk test. So that's above VT1. So the example I always give is I went to the store and I bought bananas. That's passing the VT or the talk test. And then failing the talk test is I went to the store and I bought bananas. Okay, that's a great sentence I always use, but hopefully you guys get a little chuckle. Anyways, VT2 threshold test. This is kind of determining the blood lactate accumulation or the onset of blood lactate accumulation, which is the lactate threshold. This is not something you guys are ever going to do unless you work in an exercise physiology laboratory and want to deal with extracting blood from someone as they're exercising. Probably not going to happen. So, you literally would measure the blood lactate accumulation by taking a sample of blood. You aren't going to do that unless you work with a exercise physiologist or in a specific laboratory that is really geared towards improving performance. Usually about 4 millimoles per liter is the VT2 threshold, and that corresponds with ventilatory threshold 2. The other way that you can do that is say it is the highest point, or once you're beyond VT2, that exercise level is not sustainable. And when we say sustain or sustainable, it's beyond 2 to 3 minutes of exercise. That's if you cannot sustain that amount of exercise for more than a minute, that is beyond VT2. If you can sustain it for 2 to 3 to 4 to 5 plus minutes, that is below VT2. Then field testing, what do we recommend? Or what does ACE recommend? Rockport Fitness Walking Test, okay, Rockport Walk Test, and the 1.5 mile run. Those are the two. You could read more about that. Check out exrx.net and look for their Walkport Fitness Test, and that'll basically just type in some numbers based off of walking a mile on a treadmill as fast as possible, and you put in all the information. It'll give you your estimated VO2, which is really cool, and I've used that with plenty of my clients to assess their VO2 from day 1 to day 60 to day 120 and so on and so forth. Also, the 1.5 mile run test. A new client won't be able to run 1.5 miles, so I typically don't do the 1.5 mile run test. If someone is a runner, yes, I would do the 1.5 mile run test. But besides that, I'm more just sticking to the walking test to estimate VO2. Also, there is step tests. Not appropriate for everyone, but is a lot short, or probably the shortest test to determine someone's VT, or sorry, to determine someone's VO2, estimated VO2 max. The YMCA step test, you may hear it called. Just on exrx.net, check out the step test or YMCA step test there too. But yeah, not appropriate for overweight people, people with balance concerns, the older population, orthopedic hip, knee, ankle joint problems, low back problems, or very deconditioned or very short. Okay. So keep that in mind and more or less just go stick with the Rockport Fitness walking test. Absolutely. All right, moving over to slide 9. We're going to talk about muscular fitness testing. And specifically with muscular fitness testing, this is only really important for clients that are interested in either increasing muscle, getting toned, or have a performance goal. So, muscular endurance, some of the tests that you can do are things like a push-up test. We do want you to know what the agonists and prime movers are for the push-up. That is the pectoralis major, the triceps, and the anterior deltoid. Those are the prime movers or agonists for the push-up. Okay, note that, memorize that, obviously, or hopefully you have already knew that as most people getting into fitness have heard of or done push-ups before. So, you know what burns, absolutely. Curl-up test. This is basically like a crunch test. Just reaching up as many times as you can. They'll explain that a little bit more in the book. Further muscular endurance testing, body weight squat test, how many squats can you do? Read more about that in the book. But to tell the truth, I don't really do a ton of these. I have done the push-up test plenty of times. Some 1RM testing only with very efficient athletes that have done the lifts before. But a lot of muscular fitness testing isn't necessary unless you're really working with that performance population or hypertrophy population in that way. All right. Muscular strength testing is going to be the 1RM or one repetition maximum absolute strength tests. Okay, we want you to know some of the prime movers for the bench press, leg press, squat assessment. Specifically, when we talk about the leg press 1RM, what happens as far as the kinesiology goes or the human movement is going? There is hip and knee extension when you push the weight up in the incline leg press machine. Once again, hip and knee extension to concentrically lift or push the weight plate in a leg press. And the leg press is where you're sitting and you push a plate out in front of you with your legs. Okay. So definitely know that for the test. And then absolute strength is going to be your body weight divided by your relative, or sorry, your total weight lifted divided by your body weight. And that is your relative strength. Relative strength is important because when you think about how they always say the best pound for pound fighter for a boxer, you can't have a heavyweight like Mike Tyson fight against Floyd Mayweather. I don't know if their careers were at the same time, maybe a little bit later for Mayweather, but that wouldn't be fair to the smaller guy. Even though he's faster, he doesn't pack as much power, and he would get probably pretty dominated. Some of you may have a different feeling on that, but when they say pound for pound, it basically is relative. In sport, you don't put the top wrestler in the heavyweight division with a lightweight. You don't put the gigantic, you know, 6'8", the mountain from Game of Thrones against a small lifter for Olympic lifting. So there's weight categories, and that's why absolute or what that's why relative strength is important, as you need to be aware that, you know, someone that's really small can have a super high relative strength compared to someone that's giant and lifting way more total weight. All right, that's enough of that. And then only perform if the individual is ready or is in phase 3 or phase 4, which doesn't happen too frequently, okay? Only with maybe experienced athletes or long-term professional or college or even extremely good high school athletes. Appropriate strength ratios, just know the prime movers for shoulder flexion, which is the anterior deltoid, and shoulder extension, or basically a pull-up or chin-up. Which is like the latissimus dorsi. So knowing prime movers, when we talked about that, it is located in this book and in this chapter, but it also can be found in the exercise science handbook. That's pretty much the only other test question from the exercise science handbook that really comes to be. That's why you don't have to focus a ton on that other exercise science handbook. Focus on this big book for the main major test questions. Just those two issues, two ones. All right, moving to the final slide. Sports skill assessments is what we're going to talk about last. And sports skill assessments basically refers to if someone has a performance goal around a sport that they perform, you want to pick assessments that are related to the performance in that sport. So let's give a quick example. A person wants to get better at basketball. Well, vertical jump height is a great measure for someone playing basketball because they jump often. Volleyball, same thing. Okay, someone that wants to run a 100-meter race as fast as possible, they might benefit from agility or speed tests. Okay, so keep that in mind. Stuff like that, tennis, you know, lateral cone drills, maybe things like skateboarding, balance or snowboarding balance assessments. Things that directly translate to sports skill is what you're focusing on. So for power, they bring up the standing long jump test and the vertical jump test. For the speed, agility, quickness, they bring up the pro agility test. These are all explained in your book a lot further. And then also the 40-yard dash. The 40-yard dash would be great for someone that wants to get faster at their 100-meter run or 100-yard run, as it focuses on acceleration. And then also be aware, guys, when you are performing the testing, the accuracy that you can do may not be perfect, but if you do it the same every time, it can be a really good measure for progress with your clients, okay? But what Ace mentions is that as far as fitness testing accuracy goes, you want to ensure that your client is ready, you are ready, the equipment is ready, and the environment is appropriate. So make sure the client isn't tired from lack of sleep or fatigue, or they aren't hydrated, or they didn't eat at all, okay? The trainer needs to have, or basically, even if you don't have any experience, just try to follow the protocols as closely as possible. Don't influence the results with encouragement. Just let them go at their current pace. You may want to do a retest and give them some tips, but don't mid assessment. Don't be like go harder. You can for sports and stuff, but don't push them beyond where they're comfortable. Equipment wise, make sure it's proper calibration. Make sure it's not mismatched to the subject. Some machines may be better suited for certain people and certain body types. And then also make sure the equipment is not going to fail, whatever that means, to not broken and or the timer doesn't go off or something. And then the environment, avoid distractions, make sure privacy is always kept, the temperature, make sure it's not too hot or too cold, and make sure the weather is appropriate for the activity that you're doing. If you're doing it on grass and it rained the night before and it's muddy and wet, probably not appropriate to do an agility test on that grass. Just keep that in mind. All right, guys, we got through this one. Hopefully you got some good insight as far as what to expect for the test and learned a little bit more about how you're going to be using physiological assessments. But yeah, go ahead and complete the audiobook lecture below, as well as the assignment and the assignment audio explanation, followed by the quiz to make sure you're retaining the correct information to kick some butt. Anyways, I will see you at the audiobook lecture down below. Cheers.